Why should we, stripped of subtle complications? Who could regard the sun except with fear? This is our shelter against contemplation, our only refuge from the plain and clear. Who would crawl out from under the obscure to stand defenseless in the sunny air? No terror of obliquity so sure as the most shining terror of despair. To know how simple is our deepest need, how sharp, and how impossible to feed. The irony of man's condition is that the deepest need is to be free of the anxiety of death and annihilation. But it is life itself which awakens it, and so we must shrink from being fully alive. Marsha Lee Anderson draws the circle not only on Traherne, but on Maslow, on humanistic psychoanalysis, and even on Freudian Norman O. Brown himself. What exactly would it mean on this earth to be wholly unrepressed, to live in full bodily and psychic expansiveness? It can only mean to be reborn into madness. Brown warns us of the full radicalness of his reading of Freud by stressing that he resolutely follows Ferenczi's insight that character traits are, so to speak, secret psychoses. This is shaking scientific truth, and we have also subscribed to it with Brown. If it has seemed hard for men to get agreement on such a truth during the age of Freud, one day it will be secure. But the chilling reality behind this truth is even more upsetting, and there doesn't seem to be much that we can do with it or will ever be able to do with it. I mean that without character traits, there has to be full and open psychosis. At the very end of this book, I want to sum up the basic contradictions of Brown's argument for new men without character defenses, his hope for a rebirth of mankind into a second innocence. For now, it is enough to invoke Marsha Lee Anderson's complete scientific formula. Stripped of subtle complications, i.e. of all the character defenses, repression, denial, misperception of reality, who could regard the sun except with fear? Chapter 5. The Psychoanalyst Kierkegaard. The whole order of things fills me with a sense of anguish, from the gnat to the mysteries of incarnation. All is entirely unintelligible to me, and particularly my own person. Great is my sorrow, without limits. None knows of it, except God in heaven, and he cannot have pity. Søren Kierkegaard. Today we can call Kierkegaard a psychoanalyst without fear of being laughed at, or at least with confidence that the scoffers are uninformed. In the last few decades, a new discovery of Kierkegaard has been taking place, a discovery that is momentous because it links him into the whole structure of knowledge in the humanities in our time. We used to think that there was a strict difference between science and belief, and that psychiatry and religion were consequently far apart. But now we find that psychiatric and religious perspectives on reality are intimately related. For one thing, they grow out of one another historically, as we shall see in a later section. Even more importantly for now, they reinforce one another. Psychiatric experience and religious experience cannot be separated either subjectively in the person's own eyes or objectively in the theory of character development. Nowhere is this merger of religious and psychiatric categories clearer than in the work of Kierkegaard. He gave us some of the best empirical analyses of the human condition ever fashioned by man's mind. But ironically, it was not until the epoch of the scientific atheist Freud that we could see the scientific stature of the theologian Kierkegaard's work. Only then did we have the clinical evidence to support it. The noted psychologist Maurer summed it up perfectly two decades ago. Freud had to live and write before the earlier work of Kierkegaard could be correctly understood and appreciated. There have been several good attempts to show how Kierkegaard anticipated the data of modern clinical psychology. Most of the European existentialists have had something to say about this, along with theologians like Paul Tillich. The meaning of this work is that it draws a circle around psychiatry and religion. It shows that the best existential analysis of the human condition leads directly into the problems of God and faith, which is exactly what Kierkegaard had argued. I'm not going to attempt to repeat and decode Kierkegaard's breathtakingly penetrating and often difficult to understand analysis of the human condition. What I want to do instead is try to present a summing up of the main argument contained in his psychological works, as pointedly and sparingly as possible, so that the reader can see in a nutshell what Kierkegaard was driving at. If I can do this without getting too involved because fascinated by Kierkegaard's genius, the reader should be struck by the result. The structure of Kierkegaard's understanding of man is almost exactly a recap of the modern clinical picture of man that we have sketched in the first four chapters of this book. The reader can then judge for himself how congruent the two pictures are at basic points, even though I don't present Kierkegaard in his stunning detail. Why it is that we are today comparing Kierkegaard's stature in psychology to Freud's, and why I and others are prepared to call Kierkegaard as great a student of the human condition as was Freud. The fact is that although writing in the 1840s, he was really post-Freudian, which conveys the eternal uncanniness of his genius. The Existential Paradox as the Beginning of Psychology and Religion. The foundation stone for Kierkegaard's view of man is the myth of the fall, the ejection of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden. In this myth is contained, as we saw, the basic insight of psychology for all time, that man is a union of opposites, of self-consciousness and of physical body. Man emerged from the instinctive thoughtless action of the lower animals and came to reflect on his condition. He was given a consciousness of his individuality and his part divinity in creation, the beauty and uniqueness of his face and his name. At the same time, he was given the consciousness of the terror of the world and of his own death and decay. This paradox is the really constant thing about man in all periods of history and society. It is thus the true essence of man, as Fromm said. As we saw, the leading modern psychologists have themselves made it the cornerstone of their understanding. But Kierkegaard had already counseled them. Further than this, psychology cannot go. And moreover, it can verify this point again and again in its observation of human life. The fall into self-consciousness, the emergence from comfortable ignorance in nature, had one great penalty for man. It gave him dread or anxiety. One does not find dread in the beast, says Kierkegaard, precisely for the reason that by nature the beast is not qualified by spirit. For spirit reads self or symbolic inner identity. The beast has none. It is ignorant, says Kierkegaard, therefore innocent. But man is a synthesis of the soulish and bodily, and so experiences anxiety. Again, for soulish, we must read self-conscious. If a man were a beast or an angel, he would not be able to be in dread. That is, if he were utterly unself-conscious or totally unanimal. Since he is a synthesis, he can be in dread. Man himself produces dread. Man's anxiety is a function of his sheer ambiguity, and of his complete powerlessness to overcome that ambiguity, to be straightforwardly an animal or an angel. He cannot live heedless of his fate, nor can he take sure control over that fate and triumph over it by being outside the human condition. The spirit cannot do away with itself, i.e., self-consciousness cannot disappear. Neither can man sink down into the vegetative life, i.e., be wholly an animal. He cannot flee from dread. But the real focus of dread is not the ambiguity itself. It is the result of the judgment on man, that if Adam eats of the fruit of the tree of knowledge, God tells him, "Thou shalt surely die." In other words, the final terror of self-consciousness is the knowledge of one's own death, which is the peculiar sentence on man alone in the animal kingdom. This is the meaning of the Garden of Eden myth and the rediscovery of modern psychology. That death is man's peculiar and greatest anxiety. Note. Two of the most brilliant uses and analyses of the idea of the duality and ambiguity of man in modern Christian thought are by Reinhold Niebuhr, The Nature and Destiny of Man, Volume 1, New York, Scribner's Sons, 1941, and Paul Tillich, Systematic Theology, Volume 3, Chicago, University Chicago Press, 1963, Chapter 1. These studies prove beyond a doubt the truth of Kierkegaard's work, that psychological and religious analyses of the human condition are inextricable, if they get down to basics. End of note. Kierkegaard's Characterology. Kierkegaard's whole understanding of man's character is that it is a structure built up to avoid perception of the terror, perdition, and annihilation that dwell next door to every man. He understood psychology the way a contemporary psychoanalyst does, that its task is to discover the strategies that a person uses to avoid anxiety. What style does he use to function automatically and uncritically in the world? And how does this style cripple his true growth and freedom of action and choice? Or, in words that are almost Kierkegaard's, how is a person being enslaved by his characterological lie about himself? Kierkegaard described these styles with a brilliance that today seems uncanny, and with a vocabulary that sums up much of the psychoanalytic theory of character defenses. Whereas today we talk about the mechanisms of defense, such as repression and denial, Kierkegaard talked about the same things with different terms. He referred to the fact that most men live in a half-obscurity about their own condition. They are in a state of shut-upness, wherein they block off their own perceptions of reality. He understood the compulsive character, the rigidity of the person who has had to build extra-thick defenses against anxiety, a heavy character armor, and he described him in the following terms. A partisan of the most rigid orthodoxy knows it all. He bows before the holy. Truth is for him an ensemble of ceremonies. He talks about presenting himself before the throne of God, of how many times one must bow. He knows everything the same way as does the pupil who is able to demonstrate a mathematical proposition with the letters A, B, C, but not when they are changed to D, E, F. He is therefore in dread whenever he hears something not arranged in the same order. There is no doubt that by shut-upness, Kierkegaard means what we today refer to by repression. It is the closed personality, the one who has fenced himself around in childhood, not tested his own powers in action, not been free to discover himself and his world in a relaxed way. If the child is not burdened by too much parental blocking of his action, too much infection with the parent's anxieties, he can develop his defenses in a less monopolizing way, can remain somewhat fluid and open in character. He is prepared to test reality more in terms of his own action and experimentation, and less on the basis of delegated authority and prejudgment or pre-perception. Kierkegaard understood this difference by making a distinction between lofty shut-upness and mistaken shut-upness. He went on to give a Rousseau-like enjoinder for raising children with the right kind of character orientation. It is of infinite importance that a child be brought up with a conception of the lofty shut-upness, reserve, and be saved from the mistaken kind. In an external respect, it is easy to perceive when the moment has arrived that one ought to let the child walk alone. The art is to be constantly present and yet not to be present, to let the child be allowed to develop itself, while nevertheless one has constantly a survey clearly before one. The art is to leave the child to itself in the very highest measure, and on the greatest possible scale, and to express this apparent abandonment in such a way that, unobserved, one at the same time knows everything. And the father who educates or does everything for the child entrusted to him, but has not prevented him from becoming shut up, has incurred a great accountability. Just as Rousseau and Dewey, Kierkegaard is warning the parent to let the child do his own exploration of the world and develop his own sure experimental powers. He knows that the child has to be protected against dangers, and that watchfulness by the parent is of vital importance. But he doesn't want the parent to obtrude his own anxieties into the picture, to cut off the child's action before it is absolutely necessary. Today, we know that such an upbringing alone gives the child a self-confidence in the face of experience that he would not have if he were overly blocked. It gives him an inner sustainment. And it is precisely this inner sustainment that allows the child to develop a lofty shut-upness or reserve. That is, an ego-controlled and self-confident appraisal of the world by a personality that can open up more easily to experience. Mistaken shut-upness, on the other hand, is the result of too much blockage, too much anxiety, too much effort to face up to experience by an organism that has been overburdened and weakened in its own controls. It means, therefore, more automatic repression by an essentially closed personality. And so, for Kierkegaard, the good is the opening toward new possibility and choice, the ability to face into anxiety. The closed is the evil, that which turns one away from newness and broader perceptions and experiences. The closed shuts out revelation, obtrudes a veil between the person and his own situation in the world. Ideally, these should be transparent, but for the closed person, they are opaque. It is easy to see that shut-upness is precisely what we have called the lie of character, and Kierkegaard calls it the same thing. It is easy to see that shut-upness, eo ipso, signifies a lie, or, if you prefer, untruth. But untruth is precisely unfreedom. The elasticity of freedom is consumed in the service of close reserve. Close reserve was the effect of the negating retrenchment of the ego in the individuality. This is a perfectly contemporary psychoanalytic description of the costs of repression on the total personality. I am omitting Kierkegaard's more detailed and penetrating analysis of how the person becomes fragmented within himself by the repression, how the real perception of reality dwells under the surface, close at hand, ready to break through the repression, how the repression leaves the personality seemingly intact, seemingly functioning as a whole, in continuity, but how that continuity is broken, how the personality is really at the mercy of the discontinuity expressed by the repression. To a modern, clinically trained mind, such an analysis must be truly marvelous. Kierkegaard understood that the lie of character is built up because the child needs to adjust to the world, to the parents, and to his own existential dilemmas. It is built up before the child has a chance to learn about himself in an open or free way, and thus character defenses are automatic and unconscious. The problem is that the child becomes dependent on them, and comes to be encased in his own character armor, unable to see freely beyond his own prison, or into himself, into the defenses he is using, the things that are determining his unfreedom. The best that the child can hope is that his shut-upness will not be of the mistaken or massive kind, in which his character is too fearful of the world to be able to open itself to the possibilities of experience. But that depends largely on the parents, on accidents of the environment, as Kierkegaard knew. Most people have parents who have incurred a great accountability, and so they are obliged to shut themselves off from possibility. Kierkegaard gives us some portrait sketches of the styles of denying possibility, or the lies of character, which is the same thing. He is intent on describing what we today call inauthentic men, men who avoid developing their own uniqueness. They follow out the styles of automatic and uncritical living in which they were conditioned as children. They are inauthentic, in that they do not belong to themselves, are not their own person, do not act from their own center, do not see reality on its own terms. They are the one-dimensional men totally immersed in the fictional games being played in their society, unable to transcend their social conditioning. The corporation men in the West, the bureaucrats in the East, the tribal men locked up in tradition. Man everywhere who doesn't understand what it means to think for himself and who, if he did, would shrink back at the idea of such audacity and exposure. Kierkegaard gives us a description of the immediate man. His self, or he himself, is something included along with the other in the compass of the temporal and the worldly. Thus, the self coheres immediately with the other, wishing, desiring, enjoying, etc., but passively. He manages to imitate the other men, noting how they manage to live, and so he too lives after a sort. In Christendom, he too is a Christian, goes to church every Sunday, hears and understands the parson, yea, they understand one another. He dies. The parson introduces him into eternity for the price of $10. But a self he was not, and a self he did not become. For the immediate man does not recognize his self. He recognizes himself only by his dress. He recognizes that he has a self only by externals. This is a perfect description of the automatic cultural man, man as confined by culture, a slave to it, who imagines that he has an identity if he pays his insurance premium, that he has control of his life if he guns his sports car or works his electric toothbrush. Today, the inauthentic or immediate men are familiar types after decades of Marxist and existentialist analysis of man's slavery to his social system. But in Kierkegaard's time, it must have been a shock to be a modern European city dweller and be considered a Philistine at the same time. For Kierkegaard, Philistinism was triviality, man lulled by the daily routines of his society, content with the satisfactions that it offers him. In today's world, the car, the shopping center, the two-week summer vacation. Man is protected by the secure and limited alternatives his society offers him. And if he does not look up from his path, he can live out his life with a certain dull security. Devoid of imagination, as the Philistine always is, he lives in a certain trivial province of experience as to how things go, what is possible, what usually occurs. Philistinism tranquilizes itself in the trivial. Why does man accept to live a trivial life? Because of the danger of a full horizon of experience, of course. This is the deeper motivation of Philistinism, that it celebrates the triumph over possibility, over freedom. Philistinism knows its real enemy. Freedom is dangerous. If you follow it too willingly, it threatens to pull you into the air. If you give it up too wholly, you become a prisoner of necessity. The safest thing is to toe the mark of what is socially possible. I think this is the meaning of Kierkegaard's observation. For Philistinism thinks it is in control of possibility. It thinks that when it has decoyed this prodigious elasticity into the field of probability or into the madhouse, it holds it a prisoner. It carries possibility around like a prisoner in the cage of the probable, shows it off. Kierkegaard as theorist of the psychoses. But now something new enters our discussion. Kierkegaard talks about decoying the prodigious elasticity of freedom into the madhouse, where it is held prisoner. What does he mean by such a condensed image? To me, he means that one of the great dangers of life is too much possibility, and that the place where we find people who have succumbed to this danger is the madhouse. Here, Kierkegaard shows that he was a master theorist, not only of normal cultural pathology, but also of abnormal pathology or psychosis. He understands that psychosis is neurosis pushed to its extreme. At least this is how I read many of his observations in the section of his book called Despair Viewed Under the Aspects of Finitude/Infinitude. Let us pause on this, because if my reading is correct, it will help us understand further how the most extreme forms of mental derangement are clumsy attempts to come to grips with the basic problem of life. Kierkegaard is painting for us a broad and incredibly rich portrait of types of human failure, ways in which man succumbs to and is beaten by life and the world. Beaten because he fails to face up to the existential truth of his situation, the truth that he is an inner symbolic self, which signifies a certain freedom, and that he is bound by a finite body, which limits that freedom. The attempt to ignore either aspect of man's situation, to repress possibility or to deny necessity, means that man will live a lie, fail to realize his true nature, be the most pitiful of all things. But man is not always so lucky. He cannot always get by with just being pitiful. If the lie that he attempts to live is too flaunting of reality, a man can lose everything during his lifetime. And this is precisely what we mean by psychosis, the complete and utter breakdown of the character structure. If Kierkegaard is to be considered a master analyst of the human situation, he must show us that he understands the extremes of man's condition, as well as the everyday cultural middle. This is precisely what he does in his discussion of the extremes of too much and too little possibility. Too much possibility is the attempt by the person to overvalue the powers of the symbolic self. It reflects the attempt to exaggerate one half of the human dualism at the expense of the other. In this sense, what we call schizophrenia is an attempt by the symbolic self to deny the limitations of the finite body. In doing so, the entire person is pulled off balance and destroyed. It is as though the freedom of creativity that stems from within the symbolic self cannot be contained by the body, and the person is torn apart. This is how we understand schizophrenia today, as the split of self and body. A split in which the self is unanchored, unlimited, not bound enough to everyday things, not contained enough in dependable physical behavior. And this is how Kierkegaard understands the problem. For the self is a synthesis, in which the finite is the limiting factor, and the infinite is the expanding factor. Infinitude's despair is therefore the fantastical, the limitless. Note: Kierkegaard's use of self may be a bit confusing. He uses it to include the symbolic self and the physical body. It is a synonym, really, for total personality that goes beyond the person to include what we would now call the soul, or the ground of being, out of which the created person sprang. But this is not important for us here, except to introduce the idea that the total person is a dualism of finitude and infinitude. End of note. By infinitude's despair, Kierkegaard means the sickness of the personality, the opposite of health. and so the person becomes sick by plunging into the limitless. The symbolic self becomes fantastic, as it does in schizophrenia, when it splits away from the body, from a dependable grounding in real experience in the everyday world. The full-blown schizophrenic is abstract, ethereal, unreal. He billows out of the earthly categories of space and time, floats out of his body, dwells in an eternal now, is not subject to death and destruction. He has vanquished these in his fantasy, or perhaps better, in the actual fact that he has quit his body, renounced its limitations. Kierkegaard's description is not only eloquent, it is also precisely clinical. Generally, the fantastical is that which so carries a man out into the infinite, that it merely carries him away from himself, and therewith prevents him from returning to himself. So when feeling becomes fantastic, the self is simply volatilized more and more. The self thus leads a fantastic existence in abstract endeavor after infinity, or in abstract isolation, constantly lacking itself, from which it merely gets further and further away. This is pure Ronald Lang's The Divided Self, over a century ago. Again, now if possibility outruns necessity, the self runs away from itself, so that it has no necessity whereto it is bound to return, then this is the despair, sickness of possibility. The self becomes an abstract possibility which tires itself out with floundering in the possible, but does not budge from the spot, not get to any spot, for precisely the necessary is the spot. To become oneself is precisely a movement at the spot. What Kierkegaard means here is that the development of the person is a development in depth from a fixed center in the personality, a center that unites both aspects of the existential dualism, the self and the body. But this kind of development needs precisely an acknowledgement of reality, the reality of one's limits. What the self now lacks is surely reality. So one would commonly say, as one says of a man, that he has become unreal. But upon closer inspection, it is really necessity that man lacks. What really is lacking is the power to submit to the necessary in oneself, to what may be called one's limit. Therefore, the misfortune does not consist in the fact that such a self did not amount to anything in the world. No, the misfortune is that the man did not become aware of himself, aware that the self he is a perfectly definite something, and so is the necessary. On the contrary, he lost himself, owing to the fact that this self was seen fantastically reflected in the possible. Of course, this description touches everyday man as well at the extreme of schizophrenia, and it is just the cogency of Kierkegaard's analysis that the two can be placed on the same continuum. Instead of summoning back possibility into necessity, the man pursues the possibility, and at last cannot find his way back to himself. The same generality holds true with the following, which could describe the average man who lives in a simple world of billowing inner energy and fantasy like Walter Mitty, or what we today call ambulatory schizophrenics, those whose self and body are in a very tenuous relationship, but manage nevertheless to carry on without being submerged by inner energies and emotions, by fantastic images, sounds, fears, and hopes they cannot contain. But in spite of the fact that a man has become fantastic in this fashion, he may nevertheless be perfectly well able to live on, to be a man, as it seems, to occupy himself with temporal things, get married, beget children, win honor and esteem, and perhaps no one notices that in a deeper sense he lacks a self. That is, he lacks a securely unified self and body, centered on his own controlling ego energies, and facing realistically up to his situation and to the nature of his limits and possibilities in the world. But this, as we shall see, is Kierkegaard's idea of consummate health, not easy to attain. If schizophrenic psychosis is on a continuum of a kind of normal inflation of inner fantasy, of symbolic possibility, then something similar should be true of depressive psychosis. And so it is in the portrait that Kierkegaard paints. Depressive psychosis is the extreme on the continuum of too much necessity, that is, too much finitude, too much limitation by the body and the behaviors of the person in the real world, and not enough freedom of the inner self, of inner symbolic possibility. This is how we understand depressive psychosis today, as a bogging down in the demands of others, family, job, the narrow horizon of daily duties. In such a bogging down, the individual does not feel or see that he has alternatives, cannot imagine any choices or alternate ways of life, cannot release himself from the network of obligations, even though these obligations no longer give him a sense of self-esteem, of primary value, of being a heroic contributor to world life, even by doing his daily family and job duties. As I once speculated, the schizophrenic is not enough built into his world. What Kierkegaard has called the sickness of infinitude. The depressive, on the other hand, is built into his world too solidly, too overwhelmingly. Kierkegaard put it this way. But while one sort of despair plunges wildly into the infinite and loses itself, a second sort permits itself, as it were, to be defrauded by the others. By seeing the multitude of men about it, by getting engaged in all sorts of worldly affairs, by becoming wise about how things go in this world, such a man forgets himself, does not dare to believe in himself, finds it too venturesome a thing to be himself, far easier and safer to be like the others, to become an imitation, a number, a cipher in the crowd. This is a superb characterization of the culturally normal man, the one who dares not to stand up for his own meanings, because this means too much danger, too much exposure. Better not to be oneself, better to live tucked into others, embedded in a safe framework of social and cultural obligations and duties. Again, too, this kind of characterization must be understood as being on a continuum, at the extreme end of which we find depressive psychosis. The depressed person is so afraid of being himself, so fearful of exerting his own individuality, of insisting on what might be his own meanings, his own conditions for living, that he seems literally stupid. He cannot seem to understand the situation he is in, cannot see beyond his own fears, cannot grasp why he is bogged down. Kierkegaard phrases it beautifully. If one will compare the tendency to run wild in possibility with the efforts of a child to enunciate words, the lack of possibility is like being dumb, for without possibility a man cannot, as it were, draw breath. This is precisely the condition of depression, that one can hardly breathe or move. One of the unconscious tactics that the depressed person resorts to try to make sense out of his situation, is to see himself as immensely worthless and guilty. This is a marvelous invention, really, because it allows him to move out of his condition of dumbness and make some kind of conceptualization of his situation, some kind of sense out of it, even if he has to take full blame as the culprit who is causing so much needless misery to others. Could Kierkegaard have been referring to just such an imaginative tactic when he casually observed, "Sometimes the inventiveness of the human imagination suffices to procure possibility." In any event, the condition of depression might permit an inventiveness that creates the illusion of possibility, of meaning, of action. But it does not offer any real possibility. As Kierkegaard sums it up, "The loss of possibility signifies either that everything has become necessary to man, or that everything has become trivial." Actually, in the extreme of depressive psychosis, we seem to see the merger of these two. Everything becomes necessary and trivial at the same time, which leads to complete despair. Necessity with the illusion of meaning would be the highest achievement for man. But when it becomes trivial, there is no sense to one's life. Why would a person prefer the accusations of guilt, unworthiness, ineptitude, even dishonor and betrayal, to real possibility? This may not seem to be the choice, but it is. Complete self-effacement, surrender to the others, disavowal of any personal dignity or freedom, on the one hand, and freedom and independence, movement away from the others, extrication of oneself from the binding links of family and social duties, on the other hand. This is the choice that the depressed person actually faces, and that he avoids partly by his guilty self-accusation. The answer is not far to seek. The depressed person avoids the possibility of independence and more life precisely because these are what threaten him with destruction and death. He holds on to the people who have enslaved him in a network of crushing obligations, belittling interaction, precisely because these people are his shelter, his strength, his protection against the world. Like most everyone else, the depressed person is a coward who will not stand alone on his own center, who cannot draw from within himself the necessary strength to face up to life. So he embeds himself in others. He is sheltered by the necessary and willingly accepts it. But now his tragedy is plain to see. His necessity has become trivial, and so his slavish, dependent, depersonalized life has lost its meaning. It is frightening to be in such a bind. One chooses slavery because it is safe and meaningful. Then one loses the meaning of it, but fears to move out of it. One has literally died to life, but must remain physically in this world. And thus the torture of depressive psychosis, to remain steeped in one's failure and yet to justify it, to continue to draw a sense of worthwhileness out of it. Note: I am going to be talking about these things in Chapter 10, but I am lingering on them here in order to show how organic a part of Kierkegaard's own understanding they are, and how they can be phrased in his own concepts and language. End of note. Normal neurosis. Most people, of course, avoid the psychotic dead ends out of the existential dilemma. They are fortunate enough to be able to stay on the middle ground of Philistinism. Breakdown occurs either because of too much possibility or too little. Philistinism, as we observed earlier, knows its real enemy and tries to play it safe with freedom. Here is how Kierkegaard sums up the three alternatives available to men. The first two correspond to the psychotic syndromes of schizophrenia and depression. For with the audacity of despair, that man soared aloft who ran wild in possibility. But crushed down by despair, that man strains himself against existence to whom everything has become necessary. But Philistinism spiritlessly celebrates its triumph, imagines itself to be the master, does not take note that precisely thereby it has taken itself captive, to be the slave of spiritlessness, and to be the most pitiful of all things. In other words, Philistinism is what we would call normal neurosis. Most men figure out how to live safely within the probabilities of a given set of social rules. The Philistine trusts that by keeping himself at a low level of personal intensity, he can avoid being pulled off balance by experience. Philistinism works, as Kierkegaard said, by tranquilizing itself with the trivial. His analysis was written almost a century before Freud spoke of the possibility of social neuroses, the pathology of whole cultural communities. Other urges to freedom. Kierkegaard's threefold typology does not exhaust the character of man. He knows that all men are not so immediate or shallow, so automatically built into their culture, so securely embedded in things and in others, so trustingly a reflex of their world. Also, comparatively few people end up on the psychotic extremes of the continuum of human defeat. Some win a degree of self-realization without surrender to complete spiritlessness or slavery. And here, Kierkegaard's analysis becomes the most telling. He is attempting to ferret people out of the lie of their lives, whose lives do not look like a lie, who seem to succeed in being true, complete, and authentic persons. There is the type of man who has great contempt for immediacy, who tries to cultivate his interiority, base his pride on something deeper and inner, create a distance between himself and the average man. Kierkegaard calls this type of man the introvert. He is a little more concerned with what it means to be a person, with individuality and uniqueness. He enjoys solitude and withdraws periodically to reflect, perhaps to nurse ideas about his secret self, what it might be. This, after all is said and done, is the only real problem of life, the only worthwhile preoccupation of man. What is one's true talent, his secret gift, his authentic vocation? In what way is one truly unique, and how can he express this uniqueness, give it form, dedicate it to something beyond himself? How can the person take his private inner being, the great mystery that he feels at the heart of himself, his emotions, his yearnings, and use them to live more distinctively, to enrich both himself and mankind with the peculiar quality of his talent? In adolescence, most of us throb with this dilemma, expressing it either with words and thoughts or with simple numb pain and longing. But usually life sucks us up into standardized activities. The social hero system into which we are born marks out paths for our heroism, paths to which we conform, to which we shape ourselves so that we can please others, become what they expect us to be. And instead of working our inner secret, we gradually cover it over and forget it. while we become purely external men, playing successfully the standardized hero game into which we happen to fall by accident, by family connection, by reflex patriotism, or by the simple need to eat and the urge to procreate. I am not saying that Kierkegaard's introvert keeps this inner quest fully alive or conscious, only that it represents somewhat more of a dimly aware problem than it does with the swallowed-up immediate man. Kierkegaard's introvert feels that he is something different from the world, has something in himself that the world cannot reflect, cannot in its immediacy and shallowness appreciate, and so he holds himself somewhat apart from that world. But not too much, not completely. It would be so nice to be the self he wants to be, to realize his vocation, his authentic talent. But it is dangerous. It might upset his world completely. He is, after all, basically weak, in a position of compromise, not an immediate man, but not a real man either, even though he gives the appearance of it. Kierkegaard describes him. Outwardly, he is completely a real man. He is a university man, husband and father, an uncommonly competent civil functionary even, a respectable father, very gentle to his wife, and carefulness itself with respect to his children. And a Christian? Well, yes, he is that too, after a sort. However, he preferably avoids talking on the subject. He very seldom goes to church, because it seems to him that most parsons really don't know what they are talking about. He makes an exception in the case of one particular priest of whom he concedes that he knows what he is talking about. But he doesn't want to hear him for another reason, because he has a fear that this might lead him too far. Too far because he does not really want to push the problem of his uniqueness to any total confrontation. That which as a husband makes him so gentle and as a father so careful is, apart from his good nature and his sense of duty, the admission he has made to himself in his most inward reserve concerning his weakness. And so he lives in a kind of incognito, content to toy, in his periodic solitudes, with the idea of who he might really be, content to insist on a little difference, to pride himself on a vaguely felt superiority. But this is not an easy position to maintain with equanimity. It is rare, says Kierkegaard, to continue on in it. Once you pose the problem of what it means to be a person, even dumbly, weakly, or with a veneer of pride about your imagined difference from others, you may be in trouble. Introversion is impotence, but an impotence already self-conscious to a degree, and it can become troublesome. It may lead to a chafing at one's dependency on his family and his job, an ulcerous gnawing as a reaction to one's embeddedness, a feeling of slavery in one's safety. For a strong person it may become intolerable, and he may try to break out of it, sometimes by suicide, sometimes by drowning himself desperately in the world and in the rush of experience. And this brings us to our final type of man, the one who asserts himself out of defiance of his own weakness, who tries to be a god unto himself, the master of his fate, a self-created man. He will not be merely the pawn of others, of society. He will not be a passive sufferer and secret dreamer, nursing his own inner flame in oblivion. He will plunge into life, into the distractions of great undertakings. He will become a restless spirit, which wants to forget. Or he will seek forgetfulness in sensuality, perhaps in debauchery. At its extreme, defiant self-creation can become demonic, a passion which Kierkegaard calls demoniac rage, an attack on all of life for what it has dared to do to one, a revolt against existence itself. In our time, we would have no trouble recognizing these forms of defiant self-creation. We can see their effects so clearly on both personal and social levels. We are witness to the new cult of sensuality that seems to be repeating the sexual naturalism of the ancient Roman world. It is a living for the day alone, with a defiance of tomorrow, an immersion in the body and its immediate experiences and sensations, in the intensity of touch, swelling flesh, taste and smell. Its aim is to deny one's lack of control over events, his powerlessness, his vagueness as a person in a mechanical world spinning into decay and death. I am not saying that this is bad, this rediscovery and reassertion of one's basic vitality as an animal. The modern world, after all, has wanted to deny the person even his own body, even his emanation from his animal center. It has wanted to make him completely a depersonalized abstraction. But man kept his ape-like body and found he could use it as a base for fleshy and hairy self-assertion. And damn the bureaucrats. The only thing that might be undignified about it is its desperate reflexivity, a defiance that is not reflective, and so not completely self-possessed. Socially, too, we have seen a defiant Prometheanism that is basically innocuous, the confident power that can catapult man to the moon and free him somewhat of his complete dependence and confinement on Earth, at least in his imagination. The ugly side of this Prometheanism is that it, too, is thoughtless, an empty-headed immersion in the delights of technics, with no thought to goals or meaning. So man performs on the moon by hitting golf balls that do not swerve in the lack of atmosphere. The technical triumph of a versatile ape, as the makers of the film 2001 so chillingly conveyed to us. On more ominous levels, as we shall develop later on, modern man's defiance of accident, evil, and death takes the form of skyrocketing production of consumer and military goods. Carried to its demonic extreme, this defiance gave us Hitler and Vietnam. A rage against our impotence, a defiance of our animal condition, our pathetic creature limitations. If we don't have the omnipotence of gods, we at least can destroy like gods. The meaning of manhood. Kierkegaard did not need to live in our time to understand these things. Like Burckhardt, he already saw them prefigured in his own day because he understood what it costs to lie about oneself. All the characters he has so far sketched represent degrees of lying about oneself in relation to the reality of the human condition. Kierkegaard has engaged in this extremely difficult and unbelievably subtle exercise for one reason and for one reason alone. To be able finally to conclude with authority what a person would be like if he did not lie. Kierkegaard wanted to show the many ways in which life bogs down and fails when man closes himself off against the reality of his condition. Or at best, what an undignified and pathetic creature man can be when he imagines that by living unto himself alone he is fulfilling his nature. And now Kierkegaard offers us the golden fruit of all his tortuous labors. Instead of the dead ends of human impotence, self-centeredness, and self-destruction, he now shows us what true possibility would be like for man. After all, Kierkegaard was hardly a disinterested scientist. He gave his psychological description because he had a glimpse of freedom for man. He was a theorist of the open personality, of human possibility. In this pursuit, present-day psychiatry lags far behind him. Kierkegaard had no easy idea of what health is, but he knew what it was not. It was not normal adjustment, anything but that, as he has taken such excruciating analytical pains to show us. To be a normal cultural man is for Kierkegaard to be sick, whether one knows it or not. There is such a thing as fictitious health. Nietzsche later put the same thought. Are there perhaps, a question for psychiatrists, neuroses of health? But Kierkegaard not only posed the question, he also answered it. If health is not cultural normality, then it must refer to something else, must point beyond man's usual situation, his habitual ideas. Mental health, in a word, is not typical, but ideal typical. It is something far beyond man, something to be achieved, striven for, something that leads man beyond himself. The healthy person, the true individual, the self-realized soul, the real man, is the one who has transcended himself. How does one transcend himself? How does he open himself to new possibility? By realizing the truth of his situation, by dispelling the lie of his character, by breaking his spirit out of its conditioned prison. The enemy for Kierkegaard, as for Freud, is the Oedipus complex. The child has built up strategies and techniques for keeping his self-esteem in the face of the terror of his situation. These techniques become an armor that hold the person prisoner. The very defenses that he needs in order to move about with self-confidence and self-esteem become his lifelong trap. In order to transcend himself, he must break down that which he needs in order to live. Like Lear, he must throw off all his cultural lendings and stand naked in the storm of life. Kierkegaard had no illusions about man's urge to freedom. He knew how comfortable people were inside the prison of their character defenses. Like many prisoners, they are comfortable in their limited and protected routines, and the idea of a parole into the wide world of chance, accident, and choice terrifies them. We have only to glance back at Kierkegaard's confession in the epigraph to this chapter to see why. In the prison of one's character, one can pretend and feel that he is somebody, that the world is manageable, that there is a reason for one's life, a ready justification for one's action. To live automatically and uncritically is to be assured of at least a minimum share of the programmed cultural heroics, what we might call prison heroism, the smugness of the insiders who know. Kierkegaard's torment was the direct result of seeing the world as it really is in relation to his situation as a creature. The prison of one's character is painstakingly built to deny one thing and one thing alone, one's creatureliness. The creatureliness is the terror. Once admit that you are a defecating creature and you invite the primeval ocean of creature anxiety to flood over you. But it is more than creature anxiety. It is also man's anxiety, the anxiety that results from the human paradox that man is an animal who is conscious of his animal limitation. Anxiety is the result of the perception of the truth of one's condition. What does it mean to be a self-conscious animal? The idea is ludicrous, if it is not monstrous. It means to know that one is food for worms. This is the terror, to have emerged from nothing, to have a name, consciousness of self, deep inner feelings, an excruciating inner yearning for life and self-expression, and with all this yet to die. It seems like a hoax, which is why one type of cultural man rebels openly against the idea of God. What kind of deity would create such a complex and fancy worm food? Cynical deities, said the Greeks, who use man's torments for their own amusement. But now Kierkegaard seems to have led us into an impasse, an impossible situation. He has told us that by realizing the truth of our condition, we can transcend ourselves. And on the other hand, he tells us that the truth of our condition is our complete and abject creatureliness, which seems to push us down still further on the scale of self-realization, further away from any possibility of self-transcendence. But this is only an apparent contradiction. The flood of anxiety is not the end for man. It is, rather, a school that provides man with the ultimate education, the final maturity. It is a better teacher than reality, says Kierkegaard, because reality can be lied about, twisted and tamed by the tricks of cultural perception and repression. But anxiety cannot be lied about. Once you face up to it, it reveals the truth of your situation, and only by seeing that truth can you open a new possibility for yourself. He who is educated by dread, anxiety, is educated by possibility. When such a person, therefore, goes out from the school of possibility and knows more thoroughly than a child knows the alphabet that he demands of life absolutely nothing, and that terror, perdition, annihilation dwell next door to every man, and has learned the profitable lesson that every dread which alarms may the next instant become a fact, he will then interpret reality differently. No mistake about it. The curriculum in the school of anxiety is the unlearning of repression, of everything that the child taught himself to deny, so that he could move about with a minimal animal equanimity. Kierkegaard is thus placed directly in the Augustinian Lutheran tradition. Education for man means facing up to his natural impotence and death. As Luther urged us, I say die, i.e., taste death as though it were present. It is only if you taste death with the lips of your living body that you can know emotionally that you are a creature who will die. What Kierkegaard is saying, in other words, is that the school of anxiety leads to possibility only by destroying the vital lie of character. It seems like the ultimate self-defeat, the one thing that one should not do, because then one will have truly nothing left. But rest assured, says Kierkegaard, the direction is quite normal. The self must be broken in order to become a self. William James summed up beautifully this Lutheran tradition in the following words. This is the salvation through self-despair, the dying to be truly born of Lutheran theology, the passage into nothing of which Jacob Boehme writes. To get to it, a critical point must usually be passed, a corner turned within one. Something must give way. A native hardness must break down and liquefy. Again, as we saw in the last chapter, This is the destruction of the emotional character armor of Lear, of the Zen Buddhists, of modern psychotherapy, and in fact of self-realized man in any epoch. That great spirit Ortega has given us a particularly powerful phrasing of it. His statement reads almost exactly like Kierkegaard. The man with a clear head is the man who frees himself from those fantastic ideas, the characterological lie about reality, and looks life in the face, realizes that everything in it is problematic, and feels himself lost. And this is the simple truth, that to live is to feel oneself lost. He who accepts it has already begun to find himself, to be on firm ground. Instinctively, as do the shipwrecked, he will look round for something to which to cling, and that tragic, ruthless glance, absolutely sincere, because it is a question of his salvation, will cause him to bring order into the chaos of his life. These are the only genuine ideas, the ideas of the shipwrecked. All the rest is rhetoric, posturing, farce. He who does not really feel himself lost is without remission. That is to say, he never finds himself, never comes up against his own reality. And so the arrival at new possibility, at new reality, by the destruction of the self through facing up to the anxiety of the terror of existence. The self must be destroyed, brought down to nothing, in order for self-transcendence to begin. Then the self can begin to relate itself to powers beyond itself. It has to thrash around in its finitude. It has to die in order to question that finitude, in order to see beyond it. To what? Kierkegaard answers, to infinitude, to absolute transcendence, to the ultimate power of creation which made finite creatures. Our modern understanding of psychodynamics confirms that this progression is very logical. If you admit that you are a creature, you accomplish one basic thing. You demolish all your unconscious power linkages or supports. As we saw in the last chapter, and it is worth repeating here, each child grounds himself in some power that transcends him. Usually it is a combination of his parents, his social group, and the symbols of his society and nation. This is the unthinking web of support which allows him to believe in himself, as he functions on the automatic security of delegated powers. He doesn't, of course, admit to himself that he lives on borrowed powers, as that would lead him to question his own secure action, the very confidence that he needs. He has denied his creatureliness precisely by imagining that he has secure power, and this secure power has been tapped by unconsciously leaning on the persons and things of his society. Once you expose the basic weakness and emptiness of the person, his helplessness, then you are forced to re-examine the whole problem of power linkages. You have to think about reforging them to a real source of creative and generative power. It is at this point that one can begin to posit creatureliness vis-à-vis a creature who is the first cause of all created things, not merely the second-hand intermediate creators of society, the parents and the panoply of cultural heroes. These are the social and cultural progenitors who themselves have been caused, who themselves are embedded in a web of someone else's powers. Once the person begins to look to his relationship to the ultimate power, to infinitude, and to refashion his links from those around him to that ultimate power, he opens up to himself the horizon of unlimited possibility, of real freedom. This is Kierkegaard's message, the culmination of his whole argument about the dead ends of character, the ideal of health, the school of anxiety, the nature of real possibility and freedom. One goes through it all to arrive at faith, the faith that one's very creatureliness has some meaning to a creator. That despite one's true insignificance, weakness, death, one's existence has meaning in some ultimate sense, because it exists within an eternal and infinite scheme of things brought about and maintained to some kind of design by some creative force. Again and again throughout his writings, Kierkegaard repeats the basic formula of faith. One is a creature who can do nothing, but one exists over against a living God for whom everything is possible. His whole argument now becomes crystal clear as the keystone of faith crowns the structure. We can understand why anxiety is the possibility of freedom, because anxiety demolishes all finite aims, and so the man who is educated by possibility is educated in accordance with his infinity. Possibility leads nowhere if it does not lead to faith. It is an intermediate stage between cultural conditioning, the lie of character, and the opening out of infinitude to which one can be related by faith. But without the leap into faith, the new helplessness of shedding one's character armor holds one in sheer terror. It means that one lives unprotected by armor, exposed to his aloneness and helplessness, to constant anxiety. In Kierkegaard's words, "Now the dread of possibility holds him as its prey, until it can deliver him saved into the hands of faith." In no other place does he find repose.